So let's start with our motivation and really feel our fortune at being here, especially now on the eve of the Living Vinaya in the West program, where we have the opportunity to be together with so many other nuns. So rejoice at our good fortune, at our opportunity, at the potential that we have, and to set a very firm foundation by generating the bodhicitta motivation and have that be our motivation, not only for the entire program, but especially tonight, when we're listening to the Gomchen Lamrim teachings. So we may be one person, but when we have the bodhicitta, we're representing all sentient beings. So we're bringing all sentient beings into this virtuous activity in one way or another. So with that kind of thought, let's share the Dharma this evening. You know, so appreciating our fortune, it's something we don't always do. We really take it for granted. And also our fortune at being together with a group of people who are all focused on creating virtue and getting out of samsara and benefiting the world while we're in samsara and leading all sentient beings out of samsara as well. Just to sit in a room full of people who have that motivation. Even if it's contrived, we all have it somewhere inside of us. It's quite amazing because I was thinking in 40 minutes, there's another group of people who are meeting together, who are trying to work together for the group, for the benefit of millions of people. And they're completely dysfunctional and their motivations completely sunk in self-centeredness. So if you're wondering what it is, the Senate is going to meet at 10 o'clock Eastern time to decide if the U.S. government is going to stay open or not. And it looks like it's not, you know. But you can see, you know, where their minds are, what their motivations are, how inhibited and trapped their minds are by ignorance, anger, and attachment, and especially by self-centeredness. So our minds are just the same. I don't know about you, but I haven't gotten rid of the afflictions. But at least there's some aspiration to get rid of them. You know, there's some recognition that, oh, afflictions create problems. Yeah. And I need to work on myself and I need to do something. So, you know, just having that motivation ourselves and being in a room full of people who have that motivation is quite remarkable. You know, when you think of 100 popularly elected senators sitting in a room and not being able to work together at all, you know, with our dear press. Okay, so that's why what we're doing is even more important, you know, that some people in this world are trying to do what we're doing and trying to cultivate loving kindness and compassion and joy and equanimity. You know, just there's some people trying to do that is so amazing. You know, I think it would be so, wouldn't it be cool to be able to go into the capital right now and teach the Dharma to those 100 people? 101, we got to have the press there, and 102, the vice press. Wouldn't that be cool to be able to do that? I mean, wow, what that would do to this country. We can hope. And then when we're done there, we can, you know, go and teach. What's your new president's name? Macron. Yeah, Macron. Yeah, we can help Angela. Yeah, she's good, though. And Italy, I don't know. Britain, you guys are, yeah. Yeah, anybody else? New Zealand?
Argentina.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Argentina. Yeah. Yeah, the Pope was. Pope didn't go there, did he? Yeah. Yeah. Pope got criticized a lot today. Yeah. He accused some of the people who were the victims of abuse by one priest of making a big deal of falsely accusing another bishop of covering up for him. He criticized the victims. So, you know, what we're doing has some very important effect in this world. You know, just the fact that some people are doing this. We got a card from somebody today that started off, we should bring it in here, you know, it's just, thank you for existing. Okay, so we've been talking now. We've been going through a text called the Gomchen Lomrim. And we've been doing that for quite a while now. We're on the chapter about serenity or shamatha, also translated as calm abiding. And we've just concluded the nine stages of sustained attention for actualizing serenity. So we're going on from there. Okay. So when we attain serenity, which remember is after the ninth stage of sustained attention, that is also called access concentration. You know, in the Theravada tradition, they call it access. So you're not at the first dhyana yet, but this is the access or neighborhood stage that's, if you keep practicing, will lead you to the first dhyana. Okay, so there are actually seven in the Sanskrit tradition. It lays out seven preparatory stages going from serenity into the first dhyana and also from the first dhyana to the second. I won't go into detail with all of those because it can get really, really detailed. Yeah, but there's many signs when we first attain access concentration, which is serenity. So the body and mind become very flexible, very serviceable. Physical and mental pliancy arise very quickly when we sit down to meditate, which means that our body and mind are very cooperative. Yeah, our body is comfortable. Our mind is comfortable. We're not sitting there twitching and, you know, like this all the time with things hurting and the mind, you know, like that, crazy and anxious, not like that. So the mind's very spacious and it can abide very firmly and steadily on its meditation object, so much so that even a loud sound won't take it off the meditation object and can keep meditating like that. You know, we hear like, and instantly our mind's off the meditation object. Yeah. Okay. So there's also a feeling of great clarity as if you could count the atoms. And then in the post-meditation time, there's the afflictions may still arise, but they're not going to arise as strongly. Yeah. So in concentration, you haven't, in developing concentration and serenity, you haven't started the process of actually eliminating the afflictions from the mental continuum, but you are able to temporarily suppress them so that they don't come, you know, in a manifest form. In the break time, they may still come, but you're able to catch them because you still have a hangover from your state of concentration. Your mind is still very peaceful for that. So something may arise, but you know, your mind doesn't make a big deal out of it, and it quickly evaporates. Okay, sleep can easily be transformed into meditation. And the meditation can really be used as a form of protection. I think I was telling you last week or the week before that in Thailand, when they still had forests and they had forest monks, then when they were meditating out in the forest, if there were wild animals or snakes or lions or what, no, tigers there, they would just sit down and go into samadhi, and somehow the animal would sense that and not disturb the meditators at all. Quite amazing. So serenity has three additional qualities to the ones we talked about. So the first one is non-conceptuality. So here, what this means is what they call non-discursive stability. In other words, the mind is not filled with all sorts of chatter. Okay, so it doesn't mean non-conceptuality in the sense that you know, there are no mental images or that you're in a spaced out state. It just means that you don't have this constant chatter, so the mind is very stable on the object of meditation. Okay, so it just means that the mind can stay on the observed object of meditation for as long as we wish, and it's free of restlessness and laxity. So that would be very nice, wouldn't it? Yeah, to be able to sit down and your mind easily goes into that state. The second quality is clarity. So here, this means that the mind is very clear. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily, the object, of course, is clear, but clarity refers more to the mind in the sense that the mind is free of laxity. So, and the object appears very clearly. So laxity is one mental factor that comes and can interrupt serenity or prevent us from actualizing it to start with. So laxity is kind of a spaced out state. You know, you're concentrated, you're on the object, there's some stability, but your mind's not so clear. So they say that actually some people can meditate in that state and not realize laxity is laxity and think that they've attained serenity, or even think that they've attained liberation because it's so peaceful. But actually, you know, there's still this kind of fog of the laxity in the mind. They say it's a very pernicious and difficult to spot fault in meditation that we have to be careful of. You know, at the beginning stages, I don't know about you, but I don't have to worry about laxity because I can't even stay on the object long enough for the mind to have laxity, you know. So you have to have some stability on the object first before the mind kind of starts to fade into la-la land. Yeah. And then the third quality is benefit. And here, benefit in this quality means the bliss of mental and physical pliancy has been attained. So there's a lot of that kind of bliss. The word bliss, like several words in Buddhism, can have multiple meanings according to the situation. So, for example, when they talk about the union of bliss and emptiness, so they talk about the great bliss in Tantra, it's very different than this kind of bliss that is experienced when generating serenity. Okay, so there's different kind of contexts in which bliss arises in Dharma practice, but there's different kinds of bliss. Yeah. Okay, now, even if you have attained serenity, there's four afflictions that can interfere with maintaining that state of concentration and even going deeper into it. Okay, so we have to be careful of these four afflictions. So the first one is attachment. So here, attachment isn't attachment to desire realm objects. You know, it's not attachment to chocolate, because to attain serenity, you have to be able to suppress that kind of gross attachment for desire realm objects. So we're not craving chocolate and boyfriends and girlfriends and worldly status. But what the attachment here, when you've attained serenity, is that the attachment that's dangerous is that we're attached to the pleasure or the bliss of the serenity. And so we don't continue to, to meditate and attain insight. Okay. So we're so comfortable in this state of deep samadhi that we forget about the necessity to cultivate the rest of the path. So this is a big mistake, because by doing this, we relinquish the opportunity to realize emptiness. And so we prevent, becoming an Arya. We prevent at the time of death, being able to gain realizations, or even before the time of death, okay? So this attachment to the peacefulness and blissfulness of serenity, they always warn us to be very careful of it, okay? Because apparently it's pretty strong. They say we've all had had that kind of concentration before in the past. Yeah, isn't that amazing to think about? That we've actualized, the four dhyanas, the four formal absorptions, and look at us now. It's like, can't stay on anything. At least I can't. So, but you get trapped in that very easily, especially the non-Buddhists. And that's why they say that if you get trapped in that and you don't develop the insight wisdom that understands selflessness, then you may think you have even attained liberation, but then at the time of death, you have karmic visions of where you're going to be reborn in samsara, and you totally freak out because you thought you had attained liberation when you hadn't. So I think this is one of the reasons, this kind of warning, our teachers say a lot. And I think it's one of the reasons why they don't, at the beginning, have us sit down and do serenity type meditation, why they really emphasize developing a Buddhist worldview and working on some of the other meditations first, because it's so easy to get blissed out and attached to it. Okay. Now, having said that, we shouldn't go to the other extreme and say, well, then I won't do any serenity meditation at all because I'm so afraid of doing that, of getting blissed out. That's going to the other extreme. Okay, then the second problem that can disturb our serenity once we've attained it is arrogance, thinking that we are superior to other people because we've attained, serenity. Yeah. So very easy, you know, when you start getting results from your Dharma practice, to become a little bit arrogant. So that becomes a big problem here. If somebody has attained serenity and becomes arrogant and then, you know, is kind of puffed up, so that, again, prevents them from getting, you know, involved in meditation to realize emptiness. It just pollutes the mind and, in some ways could make the serenity decline because they're so puffed up with themselves that they don't keep on doing the meditation. They just say, well, I've got it, so, you know. Then the third difficulty is ignorance. So this is mistaking, you know, one of these states of absorption for liberation when we're really bound in samsara. So I just talked about that. And then the fourth one is wrong views. So we may have attained serenity, but we may have wrong views galore, because even non-Buddhists can attain serenity. It's not a specifically Buddhist practice. So you can believe in God, you can believe in Ishvara, you can believe in, you know, the cosmic mind. You can have all sorts of wrong views, even though you have serenity. And then, you know, holding on to those wrong views, again, is going to interrupt us from really developing wisdom and developing insight. So they say that it's very important, you know, to continue and be careful of these four. Okay, so human beings who have attained serenity, in the break times, they don't lose their single-pointed concentration. However, it's not manifested. Okay, so it's not completely gone, like you have to start all over and build it. But again, it's not manifested, because if it were, it would be really difficult for you to hold it together and walk around and take care of your daily tasks. Okay, but although their afflictions are weaker due to the power of samadhi, the afflictions may still manifest, so they have to be careful about it and maintain mindfulness and introspective awareness in all activities. Okay, now there's this very interesting thing about realms of existence and spheres of consciousness. Yeah. So when we talk about the desire realm, the form realm, the formless realm, so those are realms of existence in samsara into which sentient beings can get born. So right now we're in the desire realm. Yeah. The desire realm is so named because the beings in it are completely captivated, obsessed with objects of desire, external objects. And that's us, isn't it? You know, we're completely looking outward all the time about how to get happiness. Yeah, totally obsessed with external objects and as the source of our pleasure, as the source of our pain. Okay, within the desire realm, there's six classes of beings. So there's the hell beings, the hungry ghosts, the animals, human beings, the asuras, and then the or demigods, and then the gods. Sometimes they put the last two together and say that there's five classes. Sometimes we say human realm, but my Geshe-la, who works, he says it's not human realm. It's a class in the desire realm. Okay. We often say, well, there's six realms. No, there's six classes of beings, but there's three realms. Okay. So then the form realm, the beings who are born in the form realm have a body, a form. That's why it's called form realm. Or some people translate it as material realm, because there's some kind of actual body that they have. But it's a much, it's not so gross as our body. Yeah. And you're born into that realm by being a human being who attains serenity and then attains first dhyana, second, third, or fourth dhyana, because there's four stages in the form realm. Dhyana means, it's how they translated the Chinese words, is chan. The Japanese word is zen. Okay, so it's referring to concentration. Yeah. And then the formless realm, there's four stages in that as well. But you're born there from actualizing those meditations, those levels of concentration, also when you're a human being. Okay. Although it seems, you know, I'm not an expert on this, but it could be that also once you're born in one of the dhyanas, you can practice and attain a higher one and so forth. Abhidharma can answer that. I should know the answer, but I don't. Now, the question is, when you're a human being, okay, and you attain serenity, or you attain one of the first, second, or third, fourth dhyanas, yeah, you're still in the human realm, because that's the kind of aggregates, the body and mind that you took, you know, when you were born. But your sphere of consciousness is now a form realm consciousness. Okay, because you've actualized that level of concentration that the beings who are born in that realm have. You with me? Okay. So usually the realm of existence and the sphere of consciousness correspond. When you're in the desire realm, your sphere of consciousness is desire realm. When you're born in the form realm, your sphere of consciousness is the form. Formless realm, your sphere of consciousness is the formless realm. But when we're talking about practitioners who are born in one realm, but who through their practice develop the mental state of a higher realm, then while they are in their meditation, they are still, let's say, human beings in the desire realm, but their mind now has the sphere of consciousness of one of the dhyanas or one of the formless realms. Okay? The beings in the form realm, apparently, you know, they meditate a lot. I mean, that's where Brahma and Chakra and Indra and all those people are born. They meditate a lot, but they also come out of their meditation. And so sometimes, for example, they say when the gods came to request the Buddha after the Buddha had attained awakening, and he said, you know, who's going to understand? I'm not going to teach. And then the gods, you know, appeared before him and bowed down and requested him to please teach. They say that at that time, those gods were form realm gods, but they came out of their samadhi and probably had desire realm sphere of consciousness at that time because they spoke to the Buddha. Okay. Some meditators, they talked about Achan Mun from the Theravada tradition. He was a late 19th, early 20th century. And he used to go into deep states of samadhi and then teach the devas. So sometimes he taught the devas of the desire realm. Sometimes he taught the, the devas of the form realm. Yeah. So it enables you to teach more beings if you have samadhi. And you might notice that all of our teachers, before they sit or after they sit down, before they start to teach, they do one prayer, in Tibetan, and what they're doing is saying to all the devas, please come and listen to teachings. You're very welcome to come here and listen. Yeah, so inviting all the devas to come. Okay, then, so did I go through the super knowledges before? Yeah, I didn't go through them here. I did. Yeah, okay. I didn't think so. Okay, so in the Buddha's teachings and as the goal of our meditation as Buddhists, our goal is liberation and full awakening. Okay, so that's why the Buddha taught these kinds of teachings on serenity for the ultimate goal of liberation and awakening. But the scriptures also present other spiritual accomplishments that are valued as well. And so the first one of these is mastery over various dimensions of the mind. And so that means being able to, be a desire realm being, but have a form realm mind or a formless mind. So when it says mastery over dimensions of the mind, to be able to attain these different states of concentration. And that is something that the Buddha spoke about, the Buddha admired, and is highly admired in the tradition, even though it's not the final aim that we're going for. And another thing that, again, is a good spiritual goal, even though it's not the final one, is to actualize the super knowledges. Okay, so the super knowledges are psychic powers, supernormal powers. Some of them are physical, some of them are mental, and through them, then those meditators can do things that are, that normal people can't. And that, until now anyway, scientists cannot explain. But all these special abilities are a byproduct of samadhi. Okay, and you can see that if you're, aspiring for the bodhisattva path like we are, then having these kind of powers gives you a way to benefit sentient beings that you wouldn't normally have. It gives you a lot of information about other sentient beings, which will influence your ability to be able to benefit and help them. Okay, so there's five common super knowledges, and then there's sometimes they speak of six, where the sixth one is the knowledge of having eliminated the afflictions, which is a transcendental realization. The first five are not transcendental realizations because the beings, although they're amazing abilities, but the beings who gave them, who gain them, are not necessarily even Aryas. They can just be ordinary beings, but still they're pretty spectacular attainments. So, at the time of the Buddha, there were some of his disciples who actualized these supernormal powers because that was what was expected of people. But the Buddha, he had these powers too, but he usually declined to show them. Yeah. And so many people ask me nowadays, well, if our teachers have these powers, why don't they show them? You know, because I'd have so much more faith in my teachers if I could see that they really like could read my mind. Of course, then I'd be terribly embarrassed too. But you know, but if they could do some kind of magical thing, you know, I would have so much more faith, and the whole world would become Buddhist because, you know, our teachers would show these supernormal powers. So why don't they do it? Well, you know, the Buddha actually forbade his disciples from showing off their supernormal powers because it distracts people from the main purpose of the path, which is to subdue the afflictions. So if our, you know, if people who had these powers showed them off, like, there was one guy in India, what was his name? Sai Baba. Yeah. And he used to be able to do that, you know, pull things out of his sleeve and do that. Is he still alive? I think he died. Yeah. But he was able to do all these things. And so many people, you know, were really impressed with what he did. But, you know, the people who were impressed, we sentient beings love to worship other people, but we don't like to do hard work ourselves. So if our teacher showed these powers, we would just go, oh, look at what they did, and, you know, stare at them with great admiration and devotion, and then we wouldn't practice at all. We'd be content just to have faith and devotion. Yeah, and that would become a hindrance for our own practice. So the Buddha didn't prohibit showing off the powers unless there was a really, really, really good reason. So a really good reason happened during the Buddha's lifetime, because there were all these people who developed these powers, and they would challenge the Buddha to contests of super, you know, the supernormal powers. And there was one group that just kept asking and asking. I think they were matted hair ascetics. I think your previous rebirth. And I'm teasing you. Maybe. But so, you know, they asked the Buddha, you know, we want to have a contest because we're so good at these, we can defeat you. And at the time in India, if one teacher defeated another teacher in whatever they were competing against, whether it was debate or supernormal power, then all the disciples of the defeated teacher would become the disciples of the victorious teacher, okay? So the Buddhists kept saying, no, 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 I don't want to do this, I don't want to do this, you know, forget it. And he would go live somewhere else. And these guys just kept following him. I think they kind of stalked the Buddha, yeah? And just bugged him so much. And so finally he said, okay, you know. So they had this contest of magic powers. And of course, the Buddha won hands down. Or hands up, or hands invisible, or whatever it was, and all, you know, these disciples converted and became the Buddha's disciples. So in that particular case, I mean, the Buddha kind of had to do that because that was the situation. But other than that, he did not allow his disciples to do that. And if a monastic declares to have these powers when in fact they don't, that is a defeat and you are no longer in communion. You have just irrevocably damaged your ordination by pretending to have powers that you don't have. Showing off the powers, if you do have them, is also an offense. It's in the offense of lapse. So it's less severe than deceiving somebody by pretending you have one, but still it's something that not to do. So that's one precept I keep. You know? That's nice, yeah? At least one. Okay, so. Okay, so there's a sweet story here in one of the Pali Suttas, where there's a layman, Kavada, who asked the Buddha to demonstrate his supernormal powers in order to increase the faith of the lay people. And the Buddha refused, and Kavada then asked him to display his ability to read others' minds, which the Buddha also declined to do. And then the Buddha said to him, "And what is the miracle of instruction? Here, Kavada, a monastic gives instructions as follows. Consider in this way. Don't consider in that way. Direct your mind this way, not that way. Give up that, gain this, and persevere in it." Okay, so the real miracle is the ability to instruct others in the Dharma and inspire faith in them so that they can be led out of the dukkha of samsara. Yeah, the Buddha had this way of getting really to the point. Yeah. Okay, so in the Sanskrit tradition, which we follow, they say that you can gain the first five super knowledges on the basis of the first dhyana. In the Pali tradition, they say that's done on the basis of the fourth dhyana. So you need a much deeper level of samadhi to gain it. Okay, so the five are, so first the supernormal powers, okay, and then what they call the divine ear or clairaudience. Then the third one is understanding the minds of others. The fourth is recollection of past lives. The fifth is the divine eye or clairvoyance. And then that sixth super mundane one is the destruction of pollutants. When you cease certain levels of the afflictions. Okay, so let's look at them. Okay, so the supernormal powers are being able to do specific things with your body. Yeah, so here's one passage from one of the sutras that says, where Buddha's describing meditators with these powers. Having become one, they become many. That would be useful, wouldn't it? When you have a lot to do, yeah? Instead of one body, you become many bodies. Having been many, they can become one. That would be nice to do. They appear and vanish. They go unhindered through walls, through enclosures, through mountains, as though through space. They dive in and out of the earth as though it were water. They walk on water without sinking as though it were earth. Sitting cross-legged, they travel in space like birds. With their hands, they touch and stroke the moon and the sun, so powerful and mighty. They wield bodily master even as far as the Brahma worlds. So those are some of the supernormal powers, the first of the super knowledges. Okay, so quite amazing, isn't it? And there's people who have these powers. Now, I'm going to read you something from here because, I was doing research on the Pali tradition. And so the path of purification describes the process to develop these powers. And it's done by means of samadhi, developed in a series of preliminary exercises with the kasinas as meditation objects. So you might remember when we talked about that, the kasinas are like round, like plaques that can be of earth, water, fire. And I don't know if there's an air casino. Okay, but it is. Okay, there's seven casinos that you can. Okay, I'll just read it to you. So you start out with the earth casino as the object. So you have something you make of clay, that's the earth element, and you put that in front of you, and you look at it, and then you close your mind, and you imagine it, and eyes. What did I say?
Close your mind.
Close your eyes and open your mind. Okay. And then, you know, focus on the image of Earth. Okay, so you start out with the Earth casino. By the way, you know, in the Theravada tradition, the meditation on the casinos is taught. Not a lot of people do it nowadays. But I was surprised when I was talking with Geshe Dadol, because I've never heard about this in the Tibetan tradition, but he said it was taught in the Tibetan tradition, and they're called the Ten Totalities. Yeah. So, because I had always wondered, you know, if it's so prominent in the Pali, why is we never hear about it? But it's buried there. Okay. So, with the earth casino as the object, meditators first attain the first dhyana. They then attain the first dhyana successively using seven other casinos. So they change the object of their meditation to attain that same first dhyana. So they use water, fire, air, blue, red, yellow, and white casinos in succession to attain the first dhyana. Then they do this in reverse, attaining the first dhyana, beginning with a white casino, then yellow, red, blue, air, fire, water, and earth casinos. So you go up, you go down, attaining the first dhyana. After that, in successive and reverse orders, many times, they attain the first dhyana using each casino in turn. Okay. I find this fascinating. Okay, then beginning with the earth casino, they attain each of the four dhyanas and the four formless absorptions in succession. So using the earth casino as their object of meditation, now they've already done the first dhyana, so they do second, third, fourth, and then they do the four formless, which are infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and then we usually call it the peak of samsara, but another translation is neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. Okay, so you attain all of those up using the earth casino successively. Then from the absorption on the base of neither discrimination or non-discrimination, that's the highest realm in samsara, the deepest level of samadhi that you can get. Okay, so beginning with that, they descend absorption by absorption to the first dhyana, still using the earth casino as their object. Okay. They then practice going in and out of each dhyana successively in forward and reverse orders. Yeah, very quickly using the earth casino. So going first, second, third, fourth, then formless first, second, third, fourth, in and out, then back down again, quickly, then up again, then down again. Okay. When this has been mastered, They proceed to do the same with each of the other seven casinas in turn, okay, so that they have mastered all eight meditative absorptions with all eight casinas, being able to go in and out of these meditative states very quickly. Okay. Following this, this is very, very good for creating humility. Yeah. Okay, if you have a problem with arrogance, you know, kind of hearing what these meditators do is very helpful. Following this, they alternate dhyanas. Using the earth casina, they attain the first dhyana, the third dhyana, infinite space and nothingness. Then they do this with each of the other seven casinas. So the water, yeah, the fire, the air casino, and all the different colored casinos going, attaining every other absorption. Then they also train so that they can enter the first dhyana with one casina, the second dhyana with another casina, the third with yet another, up to the absorption on the base of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination. So they're going in and out of each of these successive levels using different meditation objects. Having mastered this, they now go from the absorption on the base of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, that's the highest one, down to the first dhyana, using a different casina to attain each absorption. Okay. They develop the ability to go into the first dhyana quickly, stay for a moment, emerge from it, and using another casina, go into the second dhyana, stay in it a moment, emerge from it, and so on, up to the absorption of neither discrimination nor non-discrimination, and then back down to the first dhyana. Okay. In this way, they build up amazing mastery of the mind, entering and emerging from deep states of absorption in a few seconds. This preparatory process develops extraordinary mental powers, power, which is then used to direct the mind to the exercise of the supernormal powers through the force of their intention. And based on this profound acuity and agility and samadhi, they gain the supernormal powers of walking on water, diving into the earth, having one body and making it many, and many making it one. So it doesn't give the instructions on how to do that. That was just the preparation. Okay, then there must be some way that you do to, you know, you must have, by virtue of the samadhi, some kind of power over the physical elements, so that you can do these kinds of things with your body. Pretty amazing, huh? So that's the first supernormal, the first super knowledge. Then the second one is the divine ear or clairaudience. We often use the term clairvoyance to refer to any supernormal power, but actually that's not the meaning of clairvoyance. Clairvoyance is specifically with the eye, yeah? So here, clairaudience is the divine ear. So with it, you can hear sounds in the heavenly realms, in the human world, and in other realms and directions where sentient beings dwell. You can hear sounds that are very far away as well as ones that are nearby. So here's another citation from the Buddha, from the suttas. With the divine ear element, which is purified and surpasses the human, they hear both kinds of sounds, the divine and the human, those that are far as well as near. Okay? So if you're practicing the bodhisattva path and you want to benefit sentient beings, this would be helpful to have. Yeah, because then when all your students are discussing the Dharma, you can eavesdrop and you can see, you know, what are they saying? Do they have the right ideas? Are they talking garbage? Are they just cracking jokes? You know, so that gives you an ability to really benefit them and know what their questions are. Then the third power is understanding the minds of others. Okay, so we all think this would be kind of cool, but also, you know, how would we feel about other people reading our minds? Yeah, you would want somebody who's really compassionate to do that, not just any old person, because it could be pretty embarrassing. Okay, so here again from the suttas, what it says. So with this super knowledge, meditators know the way to understand the minds of other beings, of other persons, having encompassed them with their own minds. They understand a mind affected by lust as affected by lust, and a mind unaffected by lust as unaffected by lust. They understand a mind affected by hate as affected by hate, and a mind unaffected by hate as unaffected by hate. They understand a mind affected by confusion as affected by confusion, and a mind unaffected by confusion as unaffected by confusion. And so on, for a contracted mind, a distracted mind, an exalted mind, an Arya's mind, an unexalted mind, a surpassed mind, an unsurpassed mind, a concentrated mind, an unconcentrated mind, and a liberated mind and an unliberated mind. Yeah. So through this power, tuning into where everybody is at, they know, you know, what is going on in people's minds, but also they know the level of realization of those people. So again, if you're practicing the Bodhisattva path, you know, this would enable you to really know what teaching somebody needs according to the particular state that they're at. Then the fourth one is recollection of past lives. Again, we think, oh, that would be kind of cool. And, you know, and then all these people go to workshops. Yeah, probably where, you know, special price $99.99 for you, my friend, where they will help you remember your past lives. Well, I don't think that's always such a good idea unless you are very psychologically stable and have a lot of merit. Because one time a young man came to a course that I was teaching, and he said he went to one of these things, you know, where it helped him see his past life. And he saw that he had murdered somebody in a previous life. And that just devastated him in this life, just totally devastated him, thinking that he had murdered somebody in a previous life. So if you're going to go checking out what your previous lives have done, and they say, you know, we've done everything and been everything, then we better be prepared for what we might see. You know? And I think this is why, you know, in the night before the Buddha attained awakening, when he was meditating, this was one of the things that he saw in his meditation, was he was able to recollect many, many, many previous lives. Now, if you were able to recollect many previous lives, how do you think that would affect your spiritual practice? What would stimulate you to cultivate? Yeah, well, kind of all of those, you know, liberation, compassion, and so on. But if you saw your own, this is not everybody's, this one's your own previous lives, wouldn't you generate renunciation of samsara and the determination to be free? If you could see, you know, a huge number of your own lives, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, up, down, on the merry-go-round, since beginningless time. Yeah, if you saw that, wouldn't the direction you would go in the Dharma be aspiration for liberation? Okay. So here's another sutra quotation. So these meditators know the way to recollect their manifold past lives. That is, one birth, two births, many eons of world contraction and expansion. And this is what they named. No, there I was named so-and-so, of such a clan, with such an appearance. Such was my nutriment. Such was my experience of pleasure and pain. Such my lifespan. And passing away from there, I appeared elsewhere. And there too, I was so named so-and-so, from this clan, with this appearance, with this nutriment, with this experience of pleasure and pain, with this lifespan. And passing away from there, I reappeared here, and then knowing all those things. Okay? So if you were a bodhisattva and you could remember your past lives, yeah, I think it would really strengthen your determination to be free of samsara. Then applying that to other sentient beings, it would strengthen your compassion. But it would also give you, if we could understand our own previous lives and develop some empathy for those people who we were, who did all kinds of outrageous things in the past, that would help us become so much more tolerant and empathetic with people in this life, wouldn't it? Yeah? Because if you could look and see all your previous lives, and you know, you have to be able to deal with this psychologically, so you would have to have total, you know, forgiveness of yourself and acceptance and empathy and understanding for that person you were in samsara, who kept creating the cause for more and more and more and more and more samsara. Yeah. And then if you realize, okay, you have to have that attitude towards yourself, then it really helps you understand and have a much more empathetic and tolerant and encompassing mind for other people who are doing the same stupid things as we did and are doing. Yeah. So I think that would be one result of it too. Yeah. I think it would really be a big cure for the judgmental mind. Okay, so here from the path of purification, they tell you how to develop this one. Okay. So a meditator must first develop the dhyanas up to the fourth dhyana, bringing the mind to imperturbability. Because the dhyanas are states of single-pointed concentration on one object, remembering previous lives, which involves turning the mind to many objects, cannot be done while in the fourth dhyana itself. Because when you're in the dhyanas, you're only focused single-pointedly on one object. But if you're going to remember your previous lives, you're going to have to be able to see many, many different objects. Okay? All these things you were in previous lives. Okay. And that can't be done while you're in a meditative absorption in the fourth dhyana. So meditators emerge from the fourth dhyana into a state of ordinary consciousness where the mind is still suffused with the power and clarity of the dhyana. So they still have that hangover, yeah, from the dhyana. They begin by recalling what took place just before their meditation session. Can you remember what you did this afternoon? How about this morning? Can you remember everything you did this morning? Okay. Okay, they then remember what happened before that, gradually extending their memory as far back as possible to events from childhood and infancy. So you would go back day by day. Yeah, can you remember what you did yesterday? Yeah, how about a week ago? How about a year ago? 10 years ago? You know? So to be able, this must be such an powerful state of mind to be able to remember all these things, you know, day by day. Okay, so then they would keep going into the fourth dhyana to refresh the mind, and then come out again and keep on trying to remember back and back and back. Okay, so so they keep trying to remember events from childhood and infancy. It isn't necessary to remember every detail of every day. So sometimes they remember larger segments of their life, such as being a young adult or an adolescent. Do you really want to remember being an adolescent? Somebody once said to me, my main motivation for getting out of samsara is so I don't ever have to go through adolescence again. Yeah? You remember? Remember what you were like in high school? You know? How worried about what people thought about you. How petty. How picky. Kind of like we are now. You know, except worse. Worse then. Yeah. We chilled out a little bit. Okay. When their memory becomes cloudy, they pause and enter the fourth dhyana again to refresh, strengthen, and purify their mind. Reemerging from this dhyana, they take up recollecting events in their life from where they left off, going back to the time of birth, life in the womb, and up to the time of conception. You imagine remembering what it was like to be a zygote. Huh? Up to the time of conception, when the consciousness first entered the union of the sperm and egg of this life. It is said at this time, it seems as if they come up against a wall and cannot remember further back in time. I think remembering to be a zygote is pretty good. Yeah, but you face a block there, you know, going into the previous life. But without giving up, they again enter the fourth dhyana to refresh their mind and make it focus, sharp, and clear. Emerging from that dhyana, they again try to recall what happened in the moment before birth. They apply their mind with determination to break through the wall that obstructs memory until eventually the concentrated mind is able to penetrate the fog of forgetfulness and recollect the last moment of the previous life. They continue progressing back in time, gradually remembering events from the previous life, again encountering the wall of obscuration when they reach the beginning of that life. They persevere, sharpening and purifying the mind by entering the fourth dhyana for a period of time. They then resume the recollection process until they can recall the second preceding life. And so on. They practice developing the ability to vividly remember thousands or even millions of lives. Pretty amazing, huh? So maybe that's a good point to stop. We can do a few questions. You have something?
Thank you for your talk. I wanted to ask a question about something you mentioned near the beginning, mm-hmm. which was that all of us at some point had been in all the formless and form realms.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never heard that before. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about that. Like, is what you're saying that all sentient beings have been, like, I've heard before, we've all killed, we've all done so many things, we've all been animals, we've all been all, in all the realms, but we've also been in these very high states of mind.
Yeah.
But we didn't have, what, the instruction that allowed us to actually get liberated, and so we fell back.
Yeah, we didn't, maybe we were non-Buddhists and we attained all these very high levels, but we never met a teacher that could teach us how to realize emptiness. Or maybe we met a teacher, but we didn't take the teachings seriously and practice them. Mm-hmm. Or maybe we practiced them incorrectly. Or maybe we died before we had a chance to become an Arya. Yeah. Or, so.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. But it's amazing to think that, you know, we've not only been born in the lowest realms, but also in the highest realms, but we haven't been able to take advantage of all of that. Yeah.
I just wanted to make a comment, kind of share a story that an inmate told me, somebody you know, actually, who had to, he had a martial arts background, and then he had to spend 2 years in solitary, told me, face-to-face, and it was quite powerful for me hearing this from him. You know, the way he worked with his mind in that 2 years was to do meditation, I think, that he learned through martial arts. And he was telling me, he hadn't maintained this, but he was able to see back so clearly to his youth, to really young things, really vividly. It was quite remarkable. He said, I didn't really keep this up, but I got the impression that it had, you know, that he had been able to really concentrate his mind quite a bit, and maybe he had to flip in and out, like what you're saying there. But what really left me with was the possibility of the abilities that we have. And it was quite vivid. I remember him expressing that.
Yeah.
It's in Walla Walla.
Mm. Thank you, Venerable. What would someone do with all that information of all those infinite lives? Would it help them understand suffering better, or
I think it would help us understand really how rotten samsara is. You know, because, you know, some people may develop this power out of curiosity, but I think a real practitioner would develop this so that it would really enhance their motivation and their understanding of what samsara is and how samsara operates. Yeah. Because if that isn't your motivation, I think realizing all this stuff, having these kinds of visions of this, could be quite harrowing experience. Yeah. Like this young man I mentioned. Okay, then we'll stop here. And we'll, so there's no teachings next week or the week after. We'll resume on February 9, which for the Singaporeans will be February 10. Yeah, and for the intervening weeks, we'll be having the program here, Living the Vinaya in the West. And we thank all of you who have helped to support the program for your kindness. And we'll report back to you what it's like.